There was a man of Kilpeacon whose nose was as red as a beacon by saying it's white 20 times day and night. He cured it and died an archdeacon. There are many things in the church which are simply repeated ad nauseam, and after a while, they become true. This concerns our observation as to the consummate art and psychological flair of the poet. Because in spite of this caricature that the poet intended, there is something else here. Zophar, in many ways, is right. His sincere wish is that God would feel moved to give Job a practical lesson of wisdom. And we know that Job needs such a lesson. But of course, there is something that the friends do not know: the peculiar quality of Job's sinfulness. In addition, this ardent ruling elder is usually right when he proposes a reverent type of agnosticism. He refuses the futile attempts to penetrate the divine reality. Job's questionings seem to him a mad endeavor to scale heaven or to sound the underworld. For him, wisdom is merely a practical way of life. No idle speculation, please. He cultivates the homely proverb, such as, an empty man will get understanding only when the colt of a wild ass will get tamed. The discourses of the friends of Job constitute a needy reminder that if one can be arrogant in the midst of tragedy, there is quite similarly the sin of arrogance in the midst of prosperity. The friends of Job represent the church at large when the church is at rest, when the church is no longer persecuted. And like that church, especially in a boom year, the church, I suppose, of yours and mine, they are profoundly right, while at the same time, they may absolutely fail in their ministry of reconciliation toward the unchurched, the outcast, those who crouch on their own cultural garbage. Like Job outside of town, at a place where there are only ashes, bones, and scavenging jackals. They are outside of the church, all right, but if we do not try to reach them, and to reach them with love on a footing of equality, then perhaps we must range ourselves with Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, even if we go and sit side by side with them. It's not enough. They and we too often fail because their lofty theism and our lofty theism may be a practical atheism. In some ways, their religion and ours resembles that described by implication by a famous Spanish philosopher who was visiting the University of Southern California and who was invited after a few months to join the local Masonic lodge. He refused on two counts, saying, I'm sorry, I appreciate the invitation, but I cannot join the Masons. You see, on the one hand, I'm an atheist. On the other, I'm a Roman Catholic. Now, this attitude, I'm sorry, does not really hit us, since we happen not to be in the Roman Church. But you can see very well what I mean by an empty conformism. When his friends expressed their amazement, he replied, oh, you know, in Catholic Spain, nobody believes in God But everybody is sure that Mary is his mother. The comparison ends here, for the friends of Job had more than a religion of empty formalism. They were utterly sincere, and what they said about God was substantially correct, especially in the most magnificent verse, which summarizes a certain type of Old Testament theism in the mouth of Eliphaz in the third cycle, chapter 22, verse 2. Can even a strong man be profitable unto God? The answer, of course, is no. A wise man is profitable only unto himself. This is again this kind of hide for hide religion. It's all right to be wise, you profit to yourself. Egocentric kind of piety as well as a theological disposition. On the face of it, there might be a sublime theology of transcendence, because of course no man is profitable unto God. And yet, although you know that God does not need man, even a football star or a doctor of theology, yet how far we are from the God who is involved in the affairs of men. This dogma of lofty transcendence, which indeed Eliphaz knows through and through, since he continues in the third verse, is there any pleasure in the Almighty? That thou wouldst be righteous? In other words, what does God care? Whether thou art righteous or not. A doctrine of the impassibility of the divine. In such a view, God and man remain strictly external one to the other. God is a cold, distant, passionless being, perhaps not a being, but an absolute idea. The apotheosis of rigid reality, neither giving nor seeking love. The God of some philosophers, the one against whom Pascal argued when he said, not the God of the philosophers and of the savants, but the God of Abraham, of Jacob, of Isaac, the God of Jesus Christ. No profit, no pleasure in God. Why, at the same time, a prophet sang, as the bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so shall thy God rejoice over thee. And another, describing God under the trait of a shepherd, looking, searching, seeking out in the fog for a lost sheep, Ezekiel 34. 5 centuries before Christ, Job rejected the mixed comforts of theism. He wanted a God more human, yes, even at the risk of an anthropomorphic spoliation. He wanted a God who would go after him, a God who would not let him go. Laboriously, but victoriously, he moved step by step of a presence, so that some might be able after him to say, dear God, I do not know what lodge deep, nor where, nor how, but I am sure thou dost now come oft to a narrow, homely room, where thou too hast but the least part. My God, I mean my sinful heart. And so Job, in the very moment he calls for death, is actually calling for God, that kind of a God. The attraction of nothingness is not a superfluous element in the pilgrimage of the damned. Indeed, this fascination itself may sometimes lose its power through its very exercise. Only those who have grasped their non-being are capable of praising the sunlight, says Caesar in Thornton Wilder's The Ides of March. Before Job can do so, however, he is alternating between the mood of self-pity and the mood of self-exaltation. In one instance, he begs, "Oh, remember that my life is a wind." And his lust of self-demolition, to borrow Mr. Eliot's phrase, has swiftly made room for the love of this life, although it be a hell. He no longer refuses to live as he discovers life's profound disorder, ephemerality. He does not yet love life because God is absent, but he now dreads death. First he calls for death, but now he calls for life. This is a step. Life, however, is an ambiguous value, desirable even when destitute and yet spoiled by its mortality. As Adam said to Cain in Byron's poem, "Dost thou not live?" Cain answered, "Must I not die? I thought not to be born, nor love the state to which that birth has brought me. I live, but live to die." Likewise in Caligula, the play which is on Broadway right now and will fold up because those who can afford orchestra seats are not interested in that kind of theological discussion. The Roman emperor is mad because he has lost all possibility of love on this earth. And so he wants something, something beyond this finitude, the moon perhaps, a glorious madness, immortality. And he knows that he cannot obtain it. Life is unbearable because it ends in death. This is Job's predicament. He takes death seriously. He cannot believe in the immortality of the soul, as some of the neo-Greeks of Western culture do. This illusion that man is born by right immortal. As anyone else in the Bible, including the New Testament, including the noon of Good Friday and the 3 o'clock in the afternoon, he knows that death is a reality. As the French say, "Quand on meurt, c'est pour longtemps." When you die, it's for a long time. It is that kind of utmost realism which enables Job to go beyond this finitude. Life is unbearable, he begins, because it ends in death. In the next moment, the complaint on life's mortality subsides, however, as the hero suddenly takes consciousness of his exceptional fate and thus of his exceptional worth. He, the target of the mover of the world, singles himself out of this human race and drinks the wine of self-deification. There's a remarkable comparison between modern existentialists and Job, where precisely the fear of mortality leads, for a reason that you perhaps cannot explain rationally, but that you can observe empirically, to the desire for self-deification. To become the antagonist of God is to be like God, but not quite. And if one remains incapable of complete Godhead, one may perhaps fancy oneself in the ludicrous position of an anti-God. Because his fate cannot be explained by his deeds, Job inflates his ego to cosmic proportions. He asks in satirical jest the God whose creative power constantly overcomes the forces of the abyss, especially according to the ancient Near Eastern myth. Am I a sea or a sea monster? The primeval personification of the water deep, that thou settest a watch over me. The theme of lust for death and the theme of lust for Godhead belong together. And so Captain Ahab, likewise, in a context of sea and monster, exclaims, oh, now I feel my topmost greatness in my topmost grief. And Sendergeist, in his book on Herman Melville, The Tragic Vision and the Heroic Ideal, writes, by his solitary descent into the depths of life, man became a demigod. But the earth was a place of men, and the act of becoming a demigod was therefore the act of isolating oneself from men, while yet remaining incapable of Godhead. And so you see the complete isolation. Quite independently of the ancient cosmogonic myth, whose imagery persists throughout the Joban poem, one may easily recognize in the claims of human nature the illusion of infinity, which is summoned by the motif of the sea. Is not the sin of this impeccable religionist, this model of morality, Job, the man of Uz, is not his sin as abysmal as his self-esteem? Baudelaire, the French romanticist, before Melville, perhaps however influenced by Edgar Allan Poe, played on the Joban connection between the motif of the sea and the theme of man's bid for infinity. And of course, today man's bid for infinity expresses itself chiefly among our contemporaries through technology, but it's about the same. Vous êtes tous les deux ténébreux et discrets. Homme, nul n'a sondé le fond de tes abîmes. Ô mer, nul ne connaît les richesses intimes, tant vous êtes jaloux de garder vos secrets. Both of you, you are abysses of darkness. Man and sea, you are both jealous to keep those secrets, even from yourself. And that was, of course, 60 years before Freud. With a new twist of irony, the hero now uses the idea of nothingness that he applied to himself, that he applied to his friends. You are rivers of nothingness. You disappear in the sand. This is your friendship. When it is tested, it fails. It is drought. It is a drought. It is nothing. And so now the poet causes his hero to use the same motif of nothingness and to apply it to God himself. And yet, it is in this very act of blasphemy that the poet shows also his hero slowly recapturing the idea of a loving God. Perhaps here is another of the evidences of his sublime poetic genius and divine revelation. The hero now brings about the first intimation of a renewal of faith, perhaps the acquisition of a totally new faith, because at the end of the seventh chapter, describing his proximate end, which is annihilation, he continues musing, speaking to God. Thou shalt seek me diligently in the dark. Thou shalt grope for me like a blind man. But it will be too late. I shall not be. Joke on you, God. Your love will be frustrated. You know that the verb used here, sachar, in the BL, is derived from the noun. It's the most exceptional linguistic process in Hebrew as well as in the Semitic languages generally. But it happens. The verb is not the primary root. The verb is derived from a noun. And the noun means the deep darkness before dawn. And so it suggests the image of God very much as in Ezekiel 34. And that's the reason why I mentioned Ezekiel 34 a moment ago in anticipation of this moment. God looking around in the utmost obscurity for Job, having an afterthought. God is not cruel, therefore, says Job in effect. And yet, the love of God is affirmed and denied at the very same time. It is now God who faces nothingness. Job's hope in a God who will not let him go regains hold upon his consciousness. And yet, is contradicted by his observation. And he comes close to affirming the reality of divine fatherhood and motherhood, but this affirmation is immediately withdrawn by the prospect of his own death, which only affirms the fact that God is a murderer. God will look at the void, dreadful prospect. It is man's petty revenge on the stage of infinity. Nevertheless, after this first landmark, others appear along the way. The theological nature of Job's excruciation sent him to the rim of martyrdom in the Greek sense. He witnesses, ahead of the centuries, a truth which man's misery forces upon God. He makes, even in a negative way, a plea for the Christian mystery of incarnation. He calls for a Christ. At the end of my second lecture, I suggested that Job, through his spiritual experience, was about to make, even in a negative way, a plea for the Christian mystery of the incarnation. Human morality and human ritual, he declared, cannot run unless the God who races for man's purity receives and welcomes within himself the vanity of human achievement. Job knows God only as some drunken soldier on leave who pushes the passerby out of his path into the ditch. The vanity of good works and the vanity of religion as a technique is here proclaimed against all forms of moralism and sacramentalism. Job's experience is akin to that of some modern existentialists who perceive that man is lost, that there is no means of grace, and they do not know that God intervenes. And yet precisely Job asks for that intervention.
In his reply to Bildad's first discourse in chapter 9, the golden thread, perhaps used in the end of the 7th chapter in the 21st verse, thou wilt seek me diligently, reappears in a different mode in 9:30. Job exclaims against the God who throws him down outside of his way. And then he muses, unwittingly making a Christ necessary. God is not a man like me, that I might answer him. There is no mediator between us who might lay his hand on us both. There is a capital line in the development of biblical thought at this passage, it seems to me. Perhaps we can call it even a keystone, a beacon light. Job discerns that God acts toward him as if he, Job, were guilty. He proclaims the inability of man to save himself, to purify himself, to heal himself. In other words, to work for his salvation, to accomplish his salvation by work, by virtue, by obedience, by goodness, or even by ritual. The idea of purity is used in this passage as well as in Leviticus. It associates itself with the idea of the white linen, the symbol of priestly holiness. Job is saying, in effect, there is no pontifex. One could not press the text too far, obviously, but one may be justified in stating that here is an example of man's need for the doctrine of the sola gratia, the sola fide. Here is an indirect Old Testament apprehension of the Christian doctrine of justification by faith. Rather, justification by divine grace received by faith, not by human deed. A parallel prayer is found in Psalm 51, for there the psalmist, like Job, discovers that he cannot wash himself. Wash me, and I shall be pure. And you will be also. Of course, the psalmist goes beyond this by anticipating the doctrine of the kinesthesis of St. Paul. He says, borrowing from the realm of creation in the universe, create in me a clean heart. The second thought, which appears in verse 32 of the 9th chapter, is even more striking. Indeed, one may describe it as stupendous for Old Testament monotheism. Verse 32 implies that if God were humanized, if God became man,
then the awful gap between creator and creature could be bridged.
The abyss between God and man. He gets somewhere. He glances at some light. He sees something. He discovers some new way to bring God and man together. There might be, he says, a third party, a neutral observer. Many translators say an umpire, a dazed man, a middleman. I prefer to say boldly, a conciliator, a mediator. To be sure, the word mokia, which is used here in the 33rd verse, is used elsewhere in the legal terminology of the Old Testament, referring precisely to that function, settling a case out of court, having somebody who would decide, who would be therefore a dead man, an umpire. But it seems to me that the context must be read in addition to the word itself. It is not just an umpire that Job is asking for. He is asking for an umpire who will put his hand on the shoulders of both God and man. This is not an umpire as at the end of a game. This is not somebody who offers a verdict. It is someone who brings two warring parties, two estranged teams together. And as far as I know, neither in football nor in baseball, an umpire is called upon to create love between teams. If God were only man, or feeling that if there were somebody who would participate at once to the realm of divinity and to that of humanity, some being who could represent one to the other, now so mutually unintelligible, who could enter with sympathy into the standpoint of both, then there might be a chance of an even-handed decision, and more than a decision, a decision which would be creative, a decision which would re-establish the broken rapport. The human heart, Job discovers, yearns for that impossibility, that contradiction in terms, a human God. The Christian answer is not, of course, in the poet's mind, but the need to fit its response is his deepest craving. I'm quoting Skinner in a commentary on Job, which is already 40 years old, but which has somehow escaped the attention of many readers in our time. Job, I repeat, is not a conscious prophet, but he instinctively cries for a God in human form. He prepares the way for the understanding of the advent of Christmas, a conciliator who is very God and very man. The third landmark in Job's pilgrimage appears in his reply to the first discourse of Zophar, when at the conclusion of the first cycle he uses 14 verses 13 following, "Oh, that thou wouldst hide me in the grave, that thou wouldst appoint me a set time, and then remember me. If a man die, shall he live again? All the days of my warfare would I then wait, till my relief should come. Thou wouldest call, and I would answer thee. Thou wouldest have a desire for the work of thine hand." Why should Job be less fortunate than it seems? Here is the temptation of the mysteries of the season. In the pagan world surrounding Hebrew monotheism, or there is for it to be some kind of hope, if it is cut off, it sprouts again. But when a strong man dies, he remains prostrate. When man lies down, he rises not. You can translate, there is no resurrection. A polemic against Egypt. "Till the heavens be no more, man shall not awake, nor be roused out of his sleep." Why should an afterlife be impossible to man? Job is for a while fascinated with the idea, but it is only a daydream,
and that you will sense it. Yet, what is joy and what is hope for this divine cause, comparable to the attachment that an artist feels for the work of his hand? Notice the aesthetic element which enters in here too. And you have it perhaps in the beginning of the pericope which I read. You have probably here an unconscious memory of the love poetry of Egypt, in which there is the boy asking for the girl who's kept away from him. And he's saying, and I'm using the vernacular precisely on purpose, if only I could have a messenger, I could make a date with her. And then I would meet her, and I would ask, and then she would answer. This is the dialectic of two who are kept apart. And so also Job is comparing his own estrangement to that of human lovers. In other words, there is a negative call for the loving idea in God himself. Yet his denial of an afterlife is at once followed by misgiving, which soon transmutes itself into a passionate longing for what he cannot yet accept. His prayer becomes the infinitely pathetic, "Remember me." By another fit of illogicality, and you know the meaning of zakar in Hebrew, it is much more than just a remembrance in our individualistic culture. It is some kind of objective reality which transcends the categories of time, past, present, and future, so that the discussion about the Lord's Supper has really no meaning whatever if you take the Hebrew meaning seriously. His prayer becomes the infinitely pathetic, "Remember me," very close to "Recreate me, make me real again." By another fit of illogicality, which is yet the expression of spiritual profundity, Job wishes that God would hide him in hell, and then he calls him to life. From God, Job appeals to the reality of overruling love. The reply to the second discourse of Eliphaz in the 16th and 17th chapters shows that the short-lived hope regains strength precisely when he is appealing to the earth not to cover his innocent blood. He suddenly sees beyond all the miseries of earth and grave the face of a heavenly witness. In 16:18, "Earth, cover not my blood." That means, of course, my foul murder must be avenged. If you cover my blood, then the foul crime will be forgotten. If you ask the earth not to cover my blood, then there is some hope that some vindication will take place. 16:19, "Even now, behold, my witness is in heaven." If Job had pursued the thought of the shedding and avenging of innocent blood, he would have continued, "Let the cry of my blood come to the ear of my avenger." But the wild cry of avenging is here out of place, and Job's mind turns to the former thought of a love that will not let him go. Even now, when all seems lost, when he feels that the icy hand of death is laid upon him, he knows that his witness will vouch for him in heaven. He conceives the strange and paradoxical idea that while the God who manifests himself on earth is against him, there is someone other than God, the context I think shows it quite clearly, someone other than God in heaven who will be on his side, who will witness on his behalf. Such a new faith to which is brought by the collision of his experience, interpreted by an antiquated theology with his vision of a new element in the divinity, corresponds in fact to a new theology. The philosophers, as we know, have been contemptuous of the Old Testament God because he is described in anthropomorphic and anthropopathetic terms. But the philosophers do not see that this anthropomorphism, precisely this anthropopathy, makes God a concerned, involved deity. That is the reason for which it seems to me that there is a truly Hebraic source of the Christian dogma of incarnation. Then, in the 19th chapter, a new height is reached. In the reply to the second discourse of Bildad, Job rises to the full stature of a hero of tragedy and lets go the flow of his resentment. Note the gradation in his request. First, he speaks of the sociological circles which have abandoned him. He says, "My prayer is unanswered. No exit remains open. God has spoiled me of my honor. He wants my destruction. I am dying. He takes me for his personal enemy." There seems to be a pun here on his own name, Ijon. Oh yes. "And he puts camp around my tent." Now, he looks at the various human beings who could survive him and who would take up his name after him. "My cousins have gone away from me. So also my familiar acquaintances, the members of my club, my colleagues at the gate, my fellow shepherds, my fellow citizens." 15. "Even my servants, members of my household, men whom I have welcomed for the sake of corporate solidarity, perhaps distant relatives, perhaps widows and orphans, perhaps runaway slaves, perhaps people who are unattached because their own clan has been decimated. I have all taken them. These men have left me. More, 16, my personal slave, the man who has fed me when I was a child, who brought me up, who takes care of my clothes, who bathes me, he too has left me. 17, my wife, even my own brothers." And thus he begs in vain. "These three friends are there. Have mercy upon me. At least you, my friend." And the term "have mercy" is so passionate. It refers, of course, to God elsewhere, especially in the prophetic literature and in the Psalms. Father Abel, the Dominican scholar with whom I visited a number of sites in Palestine, told me that many Arabs today still use a cognate of the same verb, hanan, in order to designate the cry of mother camels who are separated from their young. I'm afraid Dr. Sarah has heard me tell that story before. I found myself one day in spring time, separated from the camp, and I came back hearing a frightful sound. I asked what it was, and they told me that the mother camels had been attached together in one corner while their babies had been that day separated from them so that they could be trained to load, to kneel, to be driven. And the mothers, of course, cannot forget the fruit of their wombs, and so they cry. Sometimes they die of hunger. If they are not carefully attached, they will mutilate themselves or one another out of their bereavement. And the Arabs have one verb, hanana, same one as used in the Bible and applied to God. "Have mercy upon me, O God, according to thy loving kindness. Kyrie eleison, miserere mei domine." This is it. The longing of a mother. There is a motherhood of God
in the Old Testament. There is an idea which cannot be described in noun, because the idea of a mother goddess of thought refers to polytheism. But the attitude derived from the experience of fatherhood and motherhood is certainly found in the Hebrew Bible as well as in the New Testament. Now God is absent. Job cannot ask him to have mercy. And so, at the edge of his extremity, he is begging his friend, you at least, you are the last one. You have stayed. I appreciate your coming. We disagree, but you are here. Your presence means something. At least you have mercy. It is repeated. Have mercy upon me, you, my friend. We can understand that though there is no stage direction in the margin, that the friend remains silent. And this avenue, in turn, is closed. And so, the present and proximate future are alike impossible. But the distant future remains a possibility. In verse 23, oh, if only my words could be written down. Once more, Job picks up the thread, and this time he leaps higher than at any other previous period of his pilgrimage. This might be a momentous event in the history of Israel's religion. It may be the spot at which the Hebrew mind was about to break its secular denial of life after death. Psalm 73 might be another, but it is probable that Psalm 73 was influenced by the Joban school. Iron pen working on brass, no, this is not enough. If Job is asking for a permanent material, not parchment, but a copper scroll. What Job requests then is an inscription engraved upon the rock, which will brave the injuries of weather and war, and which will remain visible to the generations of men in centuries to come. You can see near the Nahal Kelb, north of Beirut, not far from Byblos, a high cliff where conquerors from the dawn of history have inscribed their triumph. Kilroy was here. And so you see the Babylonians, the Assyrians, the Neo-Babylonians, the Persians, Alexander the Great, several Hellenistic rulers, the Romans, and then again the Persians of the middle of the first millennium, 612, 614, and then the Arabs, the Turks, Napoleon Bonaparte in 1799, General Allenby in 1917, all of them from the third millennium before Christ. There is no spot on earth on which you have evidence of human glory, of military might, great and fallen. Job perhaps thinks of that particular cliff which was already old in his day, and he's asking for an inscription engraved upon the rock which would brave the injuries of weather and of war, which would remain visible to the generations of men in centuries to come. He's thinking of you and me. Who will then be interested in his own name? He has no posterity, no survivor. Perhaps he can write a book. Literary creativity has a new meaning because it has the perspective of the history to come. Yet even this seems to be a poor hope, and thus he abruptly changes his mind
And he leaps from the level of finite earth to that of divine life. There is a strong adversity. No, but as for me, I know that my going is alive, and that he shall rise, the last one, on this dust. And from within my own flesh, I shall see God. I, even I, not another, I shall see him. Mine eyes shall see, not a stranger. My loins are consumed with impatience within me. Job still believes that he is about to die, meeting to all appearances a sinner's doom, but he knows that he is innocent, and he also knows that he has a heavenly vindicator. He has no human goel, and you are aware of the various uses of the term in the Hebrew literature. How is an heir is someone who is supposed to take up your honor after you are dead. You have also traces of the executor of the estate, or someone who has some duty after somebody dies, for example, in the book of Ruth. Job is saying, have nobody. He has precisely eliminated all the possibilities when he spoke in the preceding pericope of those various classes of society which have turned against him. This idea of the goel is so important. There is in one of the mu'allakat, in the pre-Islamic poem, the story of a young boy, barely above puberty, who is scared because his father has been murdered, and he knows that he must be his father's goel. His duty is go and murder his father's murderer. But his father's murderer is a giant, and he's a sharp shooter. He knows that he has no chance. So his friends ask him to consult the idol, and he makes a trip to the tomb of some saint, pre-Muslim saint, and he shoots the arrows, you see, according to this oracular technique, asking the deity for an answer. And each time he asks, shall I go and avenge my father? And the idol answers, yes. He's not satisfied. He answers the second time. And the deity seems to be moved by the child's weakness, and the deity answers, no. But he's not satisfied either. And so he asks for a third time. And the deity, for the third time, still answers, no. The boy, therefore, is cleared. He could find a sophism of justification, go home, and let his father remain dead. But he throws his bow and arrows at the deity and says, if it were thine own father, of the word here, Job has no son. This is the tragedy of this moment. He has no son. His brothers, his acquaintances, his friends, his relatives, the members of his clan, of his tribe, they are all against him. He's alone. But I know that my Redeemer lives. Not probably God, because through the intermediary of that vindicator, he will see God. In other words, in the light of both the 9th chapter and the 16th, the idea of the dead man, the mediator, and the idea of the witness. So also in the 19th chapter, Job is asking for an intermediary. And that intermediary, by the way, is not just somebody who will say, see God, Job is right after all, not that. No, simply, this mediator, this goel, will merely be instrumental in bringing God and Job together. This is the final request of the sufferer. He doesn't ask for the reestablishment of his former faith. the restoration of his wealth, even the birth of his children, or the return of his health. He never asks to be healed. He does not demand any material good. He has only one request, to see God. And now he's sure that he will. And people say, you can't, when you die, you just die. As if he had foreseen some of the Western dualism between flesh and soul, he said, from within my flesh I shall see him. Not perhaps that he thought in terms of the resurrection of the flesh, as Saint Jerome certainly conveyed the idea in the Vulgate and through him in many of the English versions, but rather he meant, I shall see God fully as I am, the flesh being the only way by which I can be truly identified as a person, not a disemboweled spirit, not just a breath, a ghost, some weak reality which is not related to the concreteness of my human personality. No, I shall see him. And see, there is polemic, like in which there is polemic in his insistence. He says again and again, I, even I, not a stranger, I shall see him. I cannot wait. The tenacity of Job makes a Christ necessary. He does not expect any reward or restitution. His suffering has purified his outlook. Beyond the grave, however, he will contemplate God. The poem, however, does not end in its hope. Job still rises to new heights, but this time by making himself a babe. And he can do so only after the intervention of the transcendent Holy God himself. A poet must be endowed with either uncommon brashness or with supreme dedication when he presumes to speak in the name of God. In many respects, he can say that the Jobian poet in the 38th chapter becomes a prophet. A prophet is a mouthpiece of the deity. Now, to be sure, a prophet is also a poet. That is to say, a prophet speaks in the name of God in the first person, and yet his words are organized according to an extremely sophisticated science and art of prosody. And so also, the words of the deity in chapters 38 and following, they have an aesthetic organization. They are based on an amazing skeleton, and the flesh is there with all its possibilities. But what does God do in that intervention? Scholars are disappointed because they say that God does not answer any question. You know nothing more afterwards than you knew before. That is correct. God does not answer any question. He goes farther than that. He asks more questions. Let us admit that the irony of God is bewildering. It is not even especially delicate pieces of sarcasm, say a number of critics. Are those interpreters right, therefore, who claim that the Lord scoffed at Job